Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we have a look at the crisis of eviction among low-income tenants in Philadelphia. A bill before City Council would provide free legal help, but many landlords are fighting the measure, saying it could actually work against the poor. We'll also get an update on a tiny bird famous for its annual flight of nearly 10,000 miles from South America north to the Arctic. The red knot stops by the Delaware Bay to fuel up on horseshoe crab eggs. However, bird and crab populations have been decimated in recent years. But first, just because they're Democrats doesn't mean they're happy to be in the same room together. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy took office a year and a half ago, and since then, his relationships with Senate President Steve Sweeney and political kingpin George Norcross have been strained, to put it mildly. With Norcross, it's an all-out feud. The South Jersey power broker has aimed some choice phrases and a lawsuit at the governor recently over an investigation into tax incentives meant to improve Camden. What does this dysfunction in the top ranks of New Jersey's Democratic Party mean for Murphy as he tries to build support around his progressive agenda? NJ Advance Media's Brent Johnson joins us once again. Great to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
There's so much to this, Brent. We could use some quick backstory to get started. George Norcross, again, is one of the most powerful Democrats in South Jersey, if not the most powerful. And of late, he's been extremely upset about a special governor's task force, which is investigating millions of dollars in tax incentives. Give us a little bit more in the 30-second version, if you would.
Yeah, basically, the governor wants to reform New Jersey's tax break program, what companies get to stay here and keep jobs here. And he says that there's a comptroller's report from the state comptroller that says some of this money was misused and not used correctly during Governor Christie's administration. So he's saying he wants things to change. He appointed a task force to look into it, and four of the companies that are being targeted by the task force have ties to George Norcross. And George Norcross isn't very happy about that, and as you said, has used a lot of very negative phrases against the governor, and has sued the governor and is now taking this to court. And this has become an all-out war, pretty much.
Well, speaking of the phrases, he's quoted as calling Murphy a liar and politically incompetent. And also, I saw in published reports, a quote, he thinks he's the king of England and Mrs. thinks she's the queen of England. Any response from the governor's office?
Yeah, the governor said, I'm Irish, so don't call me the king of England. That was pretty much the only thing he said. Just a pretty good one-liner.
Yeah, but, and just very quickly, this is not the first time eyebrows have been raised about Tammy Murphy's role in the administration.
No, Tammy is considered one of the most powerful people in New Jersey government. She's not paid and she doesn't have an official position, but she has an office in the governor's office. She's often seen with the governor at public events, and she's known to have a strong say in policy. And, they say they're a team and they work together.
Brent, also, back to the question of the tax incentives. New Jersey State Attorney General Gurbir Graywall is also involved. Tell us about that.
Yes, the Attorney General's office is also looking into the tax incentive program. This is working on multiple levels. There's also a grand jury that has been called to look into this, and supposedly they've subpoenaed information on Norcross, the companies ties to Norcross. There's a lot going on here and a lot going on behind the scenes. And, I mean, the long and short of it is that New Jersey uses tax breaks to lure companies here and keep them here. And the governor says it's not working that well. We need a new program. And there were some bad actors over the last few years. And George Norcross is saying that everything was above board and that these tax incentives helped revitalize Camden and bring it back to life.
Well, let's talk about that. What have you seen in Camden? Has there been significant growth, benefit? We're talking about, millions of dollars in state funding here, correct?
Yes. I mean, Camden, obviously, if you drive through Camden compared to what it was 20 years ago, it's certainly a much better city. There's a lot more going on there. The question is not necessarily what did these tax breaks do to help Camden, but were these tax breaks used in the proper way? Did they create the jobs they promised to say? So Norcross's allies will say, well, this is an attack on Camden. Look, they're trying to pull down Camden. And the governor's office and his allies will say, no, we're just trying to make sure taxpayer money wasn't abused.
Yeah. Well, Norcross has said he's being targeted as part of an escalating feud between North and South Jersey. Is there anything to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's no secret that Governor Murphy does not get along with State Senate President Steve Sweeney, who's from South Jersey and who's also a very close ally of George Norcross. So there's definitely this feud is playing into all of this, and the feud has gotten worse since then. Sweeney has started criticizing the governor more openly in public than he used to. And today there's talk whether they're going to override the governor on a veto, that they may strike a deal to avoid that embarrassment. But yeah, there's all kinds of stuff going on. And in a few weeks, the state budget is due. And Murphy and Sweeney don't agree on Murphy's call for a millionaire's tax in the state. And yeah. Sweeney said he's not going to include that in the budget. And it is possible if they don't have a budget by July 1st, Murphy could shut down the government for the second time in 3 years.
So, Brent Johnson, let's just get to that millionaire's tax for a moment. Give us a little bit of a refresher. What would the millionaire's tax go toward? And what is Sweeney's argument against?
Yeah, Murphy wanted this last year and didn't quite get it because lawmakers pushed back then. He wants to increase the income tax rate on income over $1 million. So if you make $1 million or more, you would see your tax rate go up. And that money, Murphy says, is used to bring more money in for education, transportation, public worker pensions, basically pushing the state in a more progressive direction. And Sweeney and State Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin say the state is already overtaxed. We don't need this to balance the budget this year. You know, this is not something we're going to do. We're not going to send you a budget with this tax. And Murphy has pretty much said, you know, he's hinted that he wouldn't sign a budget unless there's a billionaire's tax involved. So we'll see. But there could be a shutdown. Who knows?
What are the odds?
I mean, it seems 50-50 at this point. I mean, no one wants to see a shutdown, especially this is state assembly seats are on the ballot in November. So I know there's a whole chamber of the legislature that doesn't want to see either a millionaire's tax or a shutdown. So there could be a lot of maneuvering over the last few weeks. And this is New Jersey, so there's all kinds of stuff that happens behind closed doors.
So, Brent, are we talking about, real north-south thing here or more perhaps a real difference in personality types between Murphy and Norcross and Sweeney?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely, I would say it's more a Murphy versus Sweeney thing. The north and south thing is always played up a lot. But Murphy's technically from central Jersey, he's from Monmouth County and which isn't really quite the north part of the state. And, the thing is that the South is pretty unified. So all the South lawmakers who are aligned with Norcross, they all vote together and work together. So it does seem like it's the South versus, you could say the South versus the rest of the state. So, but even that's simplifying. It's really Murphy versus Sweeney.
So back to George Norcross for a moment. We were supposed to hear from the task force looking into the tax incentive question during a public hearing tomorrow. But George Norcross successfully petitioned that this hearing be put on hold, correct?
Yes.
Fearing that his reputation could be wrongfully damaged. Tell us a little bit more about Norcross. He is a leading member of the Camden County community. He's got his hands in all sorts of boards. He's the head of organizations. Tell us more about that.
Yes, Norcross is a true political power broker in New Jersey. He's often considered the most powerful non-elected official in New Jersey. He bankrolls candidates so he can help control a block of votes from South Jersey in the state legislature. And he's really close with the second most important elected official in New Jersey, Steve Sweeney. Yeah. They've been friends since they were childhood. So Norcross has his hands in a lot of things that stretch from South Jersey all the way to Trenton and all throughout state politics, even though he's never been elected. And I'm sure a lot of New Jerseyans have no clue who George Norcross is. Yeah. You know, they know who the governor is and they know who their mayor is, but they may
and
not
his
know
brother.
They may not know Norcross. Yeah, they know his brother. His brother, U.S. Congressman Donald Norcross. But he's this, I don't want to say shadowy figure, but he's this figure who has a lot of power that a lot of people may not have.
Let's just go for one moment to the primary election last week. Despite all of what's going on, the Camden County Democratic machine trounced a well-organized South Jersey progressive effort to unseat incumbents. Camden County is Norcross's bailiwick. This is with the exception, Brent, of Collingswood. All 16 Collingswood seats on the Camden County Democratic Committee went to progressive challengers. Is there a crack in the workings of this machine?
It's interesting. I mean, Collingswood is, if you're going to look at South Jersey in progressive towns, Collingswood is one of the first you think of. It's almost like Philadelphia Junior. But, so it's not a shock that they would win there. But, I mean, there could be – it's still early in the process. You could see more progressives. Remember, this is only the second year of Murphy's tenure, and Murphy is the progressive leader of the state. You could see more of this happen. But, you know, the more moderate South Jersey Democratic Machine candidates are really well-funded and have the support of two of the most powerful men in the state, Norcross and Sweeney. And that's a hard thing to buck.
Yeah. Well, let's look ahead to the general election and talk a little bit more about the assembly elections. And again, would a shutdown, a government shutdown, should, you know, the millionaires tax get in the way of a completed budget? Would this hurt Democratic incumbents in the assembly more than Republicans, all of whom are running for re-election this year?
Yes. And the thought is, if you talk to political experts in the state, the thought is that a millionaire's tax might hurt even more than a shutdown. So because, you know, that would give Republicans an attack line saying, hey, they raise taxes. It doesn't really matter if it's on millionaires. They could simply use the phrase they raise taxes. But a shutdown is also a dirty word after what happened in Washington this winter. Mm-hmm. You know, we saw a 33 or 34 day shutdown in Washington. And, you know, you don't want to have that. You know, you say the shutdown people, they're going to do a shutdown again and people's 4th of July are going to be ruined. So, you know, there's tough political headwinds going on for the assembly and for everybody involved here.
So Democrats right now are in control with 54 of the 80 seats. Do Republicans really have a chance?
The hope they have is that everybody may see all this Democratic dysfunction and go, hey, the Democrats aren't working. Let's give the Republicans a chance. But the Republican Party is not in the best of shape in New Jersey.
Yeah, they're still wringing their hands over. They're divided over President Trump, correct?
Yes.
Many of them?
They have that going for them. They have, in the wake of the Chris Christie years, where Christie left office with a lower approval rating, even though that's fading a little bit because now Murphy's taken the platform. But yeah, it's not an easy time to be a Republican in New Jersey right now.
So back to George Norcross for a moment. Why did he never run for election?
He has more power without it. Meaning if he can be behind the scenes and help pull strings, there's no need. Meaning if he runs for a specific position, he may only have power in that position. But this way he could work more behind the scenes all over the place.
Yeah. Well, so Brent, how do you see all this playing out with the tax incentive investigation? Is this something, just as an observer, you think Norcross really needs to be concerned about? He's been around a long time.
Well, yeah, I mean, because the governor's not backing down, meaning there's the attorney general's involved, the task force is involved. You have the governor using the bully pulpit at news conferences talking about how much this is needed. And to be fair to the governor, he has not himself targeted Norcross. He has not really fought back. He tends to take, for lack of a better term, the high road on a lot of these things, whereas Norcross fights back. But yeah, I don't see this going away. In fact, the current tax incentive program is set to expire July 1st. Yeah. And it could happen where we have no tax incentive program come July 1st.
Brent Johnson.
There's a lot going on.
Stay tuned, right?
Yep.
Brent Johnson, reporter covering politics for NJ Advance Media. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And just ahead, we'll talk about the eviction crisis in Philadelphia and a new bill in city council that would provide low-income tenants with free legal counsel. Expert Rashida Phillips will be along for more on that. Stay close. You're listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. For the person or family living in poverty and facing eviction, the prospect of homelessness is very real, especially if they are unable to afford the legal assistance necessary to face a landlord in court. However, relief could be on the way for low-income tenants living in Philly. A bill before City Council would offer those with incomes below 200% of the poverty line free legal help in landlord-tenant court. At the same time, a landlord's group is fighting the measure, saying it could actually hurt families who are seeking to rent properties. Rashida Phillips joins us now. She is an attorney with extensive experience in representing low-income tenants facing eviction. As a former managing attorney of the housing unit at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, nice to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Rashida, to begin, tell us about some of the people, the families you've worked with, and the challenges they face that bring them to the brink of eviction from their homes or apartments.
Well, as you know, Philadelphia is one of the poorest, largest cities in the country, with a pretty deep poverty rate. The people who are impacted by that poverty rate are typically Philadelphia's most vulnerable communities. It's our women and children and their families. It's seniors. It's folks who are disabled, immigrants, and folks who don't speak English as their first language. So these are typically the people who can be subject to these types of situations. And in many cases, when you're faced with eviction, a lot of the cases that end up in eviction court, at first blush, it would appear that it's because of money. But often, that's not the full story of the situation. In a lot of situations, people are withholding their rent because they have difficult housing conditions, substandard housing conditions where they should not be paying the full rent, or there are situations where the landlord is not properly licensed, has not provided the proper certification. So as you may know, in Philly, we're seeing high rates of lead poisoning in a lot of young children. Sometimes these situations are a result of their rental condition. So we see all kinds of range of situations that come into community legal services in terms of people who are facing eviction and need that legal assistance to help them wade through the situation, help them untangle what may actually be happening, and help them, either to stay in the property or to find resources to help them pay the back rent or to push the landlord to make repairs that will, that are negatively impacting people's health and safety in their housing units.
So let's talk a little bit. Legal fees obviously can be enormously expensive. What sorts of incomes are we talking about with these families, and how do these incomes translate when we're talking about covering daily needs like food, clothing, shoes, and heat, that sort of thing?
Sure. Well, many people, in particular low-income people, are paying more than 30% of their income towards rent. In some cases, they're paying up to 50% of their income towards rent. And that's a lot. If you're in a subsidized housing program, you don't pay more than 30% of your income, because that's been recognized as, a proportionate amount that you should be paying towards your income, towards your housing, out of your income every month. But people are far exceeding that. And we're talking people who are below 200% of the poverty line. So we're talking people who are not making that much. And depending on the family size, they're in many cases making less than $20,000 a year. The stability that stable housing brings to a family, especially a low-income family, can't be underestimated. It's immensely important that you have a stable housing situation so that you can go to work, so that you can take your kids to school every day, and not be at risk of homelessness and housing instability that just thrusts people further into poverty. And again, sometimes we look at this situation as a matter of people are low income, people are poor, and therefore they become housing unstable. Mm-hmm. But work like Matt Desmond's evicted work and what we're seeing in our work representing low income tenants is that it's often the other way around. So people who aren't, people who are potentially at the edge of poverty but are still, okay and still able to make it, they're thrust further into poverty or just thrust into a cycle of poverty after facing housing instability and eviction.
Rashida,
so it really exacerbates people's poverty.
If an eviction proceeding does go to landlord-tenant court, the imbalance in representation between tenant and landlord is often striking. I mean, most low-income tenants don't have counsel. Most landlords do.
That's correct. So on average, about 85% of landlords who are in eviction court have legal representation. On the other hand, only 5-7% of tenants get legal representation. So
and the odds are
a huge power.
I'm so sorry. I just jumped in on you. I apologize.
Sure. No, it's okay.
The odds are if you have no counsel, you lose, correct?
Exactly. And losing looks differently depending on the person. So losing could mean that, at worst, you're being evicted out of the property within 21 days. But losing could also mean you're paying, back a bunch of fees that, you may not even owe or that, again, are going to thrust you into poverty because it's not a payment agreement that fits in line with your circumstances. So you have people who are paying back, something like $3,000 within 30 days. And if they don't make that payment, then they're evicted through that process. So,
And in Philadelphia, this issue is an issue in particular within communities of color.
Exactly. Yeah. So what we found, the Reinvestment Fund, which is an organization based in Philly, did some research a couple of years ago. And what they found that was really striking, which was that African Americans across the board in Philadelphia face higher rates of eviction. And so this is not even accounting for income. So it's not just an issue of poverty. The families that are being evicted are across the board in terms of income. They're low income as well as middle income and some even higher. But what we're seeing is that the high rates of evictions for African American families in particular hold despite income. So families in Germantown, families in some areas of the city that are considered, you know, middle class or upper middle class are seeing high rates of eviction for their African American families. So what we've been trying to emphasize is that it goes beyond poverty. It's actually a racial justice issue. It's also a gender justice issue when you see that the families that are primarily being evicted are African American women headed families. So, you know, we have a real problem that goes just beyond that people are poor and can't afford their rent. It's actually a racial justice and a gender justice crisis as well.
If a tenant does have counsel, what are the odds of prevailing in court?
So what we found, so there was a report that the Philadelphia Bar Association supported that was done by a firm called Stout. And what they saw was that where people are represented, they are able to avoid disruptive displacement in 78% of their cases. And so what that disruptive displacement means is that lawyers are helping people to avoid homelessness. And that might not mean keeping them in a property that they can't afford or one that's not habitable for them. But what that could mean is that lawyers are able to help people negotiate more time or negotiate better payment agreements that allow them to avoid homelessness and avoid eviction. And so that's what we mean by disruptive displacement. We're able to help tenants get into situations that help them avoid those situations that are going to spiral them into poverty and spiral them into homelessness. And that could include a broad range of different solutions depending on the case or the situation. So that report found that, you know, again, where a lawyer is a part of the case and representing a tenant, they're able to help them negotiate better outcomes that help them to avoid homelessness and eviction. And that's what we want ultimately.
Thus avoiding, you know, changes, hopefully, for children in school situations and people
exactly.
can continue, you know, to work at their jobs. What would Councilwoman Helen Gimm's bill do?
So Councilwoman Helen Gimm's bill would provide that. And I should also say that this is part of a larger movement happening around the country. And it's this notion of providing a right to counsel in these very critical legal proceedings where so much is at risk that, you know, it's a lack of access to justice. And it's an imbalance of justice if you don't provide, you know, kind of the same rates of legal representation on either side. And so we should not have a situation that's so imbalanced where, you know, fewer than 90% of people, tenants ending up in eviction court don't have representation. So this is really a movement that was inspired in New York City is the first place to pass a right to counsel for low-income tenants. So we really look towards them and use them as an example for what we would want to see happen in Philadelphia. And so Councilwoman Gimm introduced that bill a couple of weeks ago, and it was co-sponsored by several other council members. And that bill would provide a guarantee of access to legal representation for tenants who are at 200% of the federal poverty line in Philadelphia. And it would also, in addition, provide access to education. And so I think Council Gimm and others have recognized that in addition to the legal representation, it's also really important that people have information and access to education about what their rights are, both landlords and tenants alike, so that, again, these situations, you know, we can try to work things out before eviction comes and people can understand what their legal rights and options are.
Rashida, for those who do end up in court and who do have representation, what are you hearing from them about the difference that it might make?
Oh, it makes a vast difference. I think for a lot of people, when you're walking into eviction court, it's an extremely intimidating place. It's not a user-friendly place as it stands now. And they're working to make some improvements on that. And I think the Philadelphia Eviction Prevention Project, which CLS started in collaboration with our nonprofit partners, is working to change some of that culture. But when you walk in, it's an extremely intimidating place. It's not a place where you feel like you can speak and be heard. Most people aren't represented most tenants aren't represented in that court. And so they're facing another lawyer on the other side who they may be talking to you, but they're not representing you. And so you don't really know what your options are. And it becomes a really intimidating place. And again, something so critical as your housing. You don't want to be part of a culture of fear where you don't know what's going to happen next, especially if you have children or other circumstances. And so we hear that from people all the time. And just the power of having someone who's there on your side and there for you to speak for you and to help you to present your story. I mean, part of it also, right, is that when you're walking into that courtroom and you're going in front of a judge, you have to be able to present your story a certain way that not all people can do that. They can't gather the documentation and the evidence that's needed in order to make a coherent story that someone's going to listen to or in order to raise their legal defenses. Again, as I said, in a lot of situations, people should be withholding rent because their landlord doesn't have a license or the conditions are so bad that you should not be reasonably paying any rent in that particular property. In Philadelphia in particular, we have an old housing stock. Many of our houses were built, around the 1900s. And so a lot of these places do have very bad housing conditions or were built before 1978. And so there may be lead paint present, all of these sorts of things. But
and it's a complex process to get through, to be able to represent yourself and have a chance.
Exactly.
Yep. Rashida Phillips. Rashida, by the way, let me reintroduce you. Former managing attorney of the housing unit at Community Legal Services of Philadelphia, has had extensive experience in representing lower income tenants who are facing eviction. Rashida, the Homeowners Association of Philadelphia represents hundreds of landlords, and Vice President Vince Pinckney paraphrases saying the bill could cause landlords to shun low-income tenants and maybe even prompt some landlords to upgrade so they can charge higher rents. Could this measure potentially backfire on those who have little money but who want and need to be able to prevail in their housing situations?
Well, I would hope it would, and I think that really concerns me, that kind of language and challenge to this, because to me, that sounds like that could potentially lead to housing discrimination, right? The Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations, and we also have a state body on human relations, protects certain classes of folks, and that includes protects folks based on familial status, protects folks locally, at least based on source of income. And so when you start to get into that and we're going to start to deny tenants who are low income just because they have this right to legal counsel, that really concerns me that leads and sounds a lot like housing discrimination. And I would say, folks should be careful about that, because we do have protections against that in Philadelphia, fortunately. But I would also just push back and challenge that. I think what we hear from a lot of landlord attorneys and landlord-tenant court is that it's actually helpful to have someone on the other side. You can actually work through a resolution quicker when you have lawyers on both sides of the aisle trying to, having common language and being able to work through the issues. What we hear is when a tenant is unrepresented and there's a lawyer on the other side, it can really drag out the process and make things more inefficient, because, again, you don't have the tenant who kind of has an understanding of the landscape and knows what all the different rights are and the different timelines and things like that. So we actually hear very often that it's really helpful to have a lawyer representing on the other side and to be able to work through a resolution with legal counsel on both sides.
So again, of course, the goal is to keep families in place, or at least even get them into a better situation, and to prevent families from ending up on the street. Caring for the homeless population, Rashida, it costs the city of Philadelphia, what is it, tens of millions every year?
Probably thousands.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, where are the support services? Let's go over that again. If a family does end up on the street, what are those support services? What does the city need to provide? I think the thing that I had read was that it would actually cost less to invest in legal aid for these families than to have to, work on the other end and try to help them out of homelessness.
That's right. And so what that Stout report showed that I talked about a little bit earlier was that when you invest $3.5 million per year into legal representation for low-income tenants, you're saving the city and taxpayers in the city $45 million per year on the return on investment. And so, that's a huge cost savings, because, again, when people are faced with eviction, facing housing instability, and facing homelessness, they're having to access various services and systems and support services in order to get back on their feet. And so they're accessing the homeless shelter. They're accessing mental health, the Department of Behavioral Health Services. They're accessing you know, all of these different services that cost the city and cost taxpayers money to do when folks are facing housing instability. And so why not put that money into working out resolutions that either keep people housed in place, help them to improve their housing conditions, or get them into situations that are more affordable or better for their for themselves and their families. And so I think that's the point of that kind of statistic, is that it really does balance out, and it really it makes good fiscal sense for a city to make that kind of investment.
Rashida, where's the city in efforts to provide quality affordable housing for those with very low incomes?
I think they're trying to move the needle. There's been a number of different there was last year a comprehensive housing action plan that was put out that's contemplating building a couple hundred thousand of affordable housing units. And I think there's been a number of other measures to look at it and see. But, you know, the thing that we emphasize is that we're not going to be able to build ourselves out of an affordable housing crisis, right? By the time you build the units that are needed, you have a whole other set of folks who have been homeless in that time period. And you still have many barriers to being able to access affordable housing. So, for example, if it's housing that's being subsidized by HUD, you know, there may be wait lists involved and other things that really prevent folks from being able to access that affordable housing. And so we really need other solutions and remedies. You know, in addition to building more affordable housing, we need remedies that are also going to help people stay in place and prevent the sort of displacement that we're seeing happen in Philadelphia.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
I was just going to say that sometimes that displacement is not even about folks falling behind on their rent or being legally evicted. Sometimes what we're also seeing in Philadelphia as a result of some of the gentrification happening is these mass displacements happening from entire buildings, where entire buildings are having their leases terminated and being put out of the building because the landlord wants to turn it into, or the owner wants to turn it into a high luxury rental or market rental.
So gentrification, boy, that's a whole nother show. Rashida Phillips, unfortunately, we are out of time, but you're about to start a new job at Sergeant Shriver National Center on Poverty Law, we understand. So our very best to you. And
thank you so much.
And we'll be in touch. Thanks.
Yep. All right. Bye.
All right. Just ahead, the plight of the red knot and also the horseshoe crab population along the Delaware Bay. Eric Stiles of the New Jersey Audubon Society will be with us in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Every year at this time, a tiny bird weighing about 5 ounces stops by the Delaware Bay as it heads from its winter home at the very tip of South America to breeding grounds in the Arctic Circle, a trip of about 9,300 miles. At the same time, hundreds of thousands of horseshoe crabs gather at the Delaware Bay to breed, releasing billions of eggs at high tide and during full and new moons. These eggs are critical to the red knot's survival, helping this migratory bird fatten up for the final long leg of its trip north. However, in recent decades, the red knot's numbers have crashed. Horseshoe crabs have been overfished for bait and science, and so there are many fewer eggs. For the next 20 minutes or so, we'll check in with Eric Stiles, president and CEO of the New Jersey Audubon Society, to get an update on the progress of conservation efforts. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be chatting with you today.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you with us. The red knot is listed as a threatened species. Tell us about some of the scarier population numbers in recent years as compared to, say, before the 1960s.
Absolutely. And as a child who grew up listening to WHYY, it's an honor to speak with you. I think to provide the context, the Delaware Bay is literally the Serengeti of the Mid-Atlantic region. It hosts the largest remaining horseshoe crab population in the world and is one of the top 4 most important places on the planet for migrating shorebirds. When you look at migration, it's typically a gamble. The birds are taking the chance that there's enough food and habitat along the way to pay off on its journey where it faces increased mortality. Now, Delaware Bay was an exception. When the shorebirds flew from South America all the way to the Delaware Bay, they would metabolize their own fat reserves, but also break down and consume their own muscles and tissues. They would descend on the Delaware Bay, where they would literally find the beaches coated in green. They would consume horseshoe crab eggs. It's kind of like the film Super Size Me, these little fat balls, and they would double their body weight in 7 to 10 days, and then fly nonstop up to the Arctic, where they would breed. So this land of plenty, this land of abundance, our heritage was stolen from us. In the 1990s, and I saw this firsthand working as an endangered species biologist on the Delaware Bay Shore of New Jersey, tractor trailer after tractor trailer from as far north as New York and as far south as Virginia would pull up and literally take every adult crab from the bay, load them up into their tractor trailers, and long haul them as bait for eel and conch. Hmm. As the crabs disappeared, their eggs also disappeared, leading to a plummet of the eggs available for for shorebirds and shorebirds themselves. So scientists in 1991 documented, this is just 1 square meter of beach. There was between 70 and over 100,000 eggs per meter square. Red knots were as high as 130,000. Today, the red knots have a population of a little bit over 30,000, and the horseshoe crab eggs is as low as 4,000 to 7,000 per meter square. Hmm. So you can get a sense of this land of plenty becoming a land of few, the land of the scarce.
Eric, describe the bird for us briefly. Its looks, its personality, and we're talking about a variety called the Rufa red knot?
Yeah, the Rufa red knot is a subspecies of the red knot population, but it's important to know the red knot's at the tip of the spear. There's 6 other species of shorebirds that are facing the same decline. So red knots are this brilliant red-breasted bird, a little bit larger than a robin. And imagine that bird wintering in Tierra del Fuego, the southernmost tip of South America, puddle jumping up to Brazil and then flying nonstop to the Delaware Bay. And imagine the amount of energy it would take to something that small to literally fly through the night nonstop and come to our special Serengeti.
It's almost beyond imagination, but not surprising that they're emaciated when they get to the Delaware Bay. So, and you said, during its brief stay at the bay, the red knot and these other birds, who are migratory birds, gorge on the eggs. The horseshoe crab has been, as you mentioned, has been overfished. And Eric, it's also used by the biomedical industry. Tell us more about the blood that is, I think, what is it, like a bright blue in color that
it's
is harvested?
Called,
go ahead.
Yes, it's called blue gold. And this is the second source of the stressor on the horseshoe crab population. So female crabs are larger than male crabs, and think of them as a 400-million-year-old trilobite that has made it through a couple of mass extinctions. The horseshoe crabs are brought into captivity. They are bled up to 30% or more of their blood volume, and it has this unique property where it can detect medical impurities, biotoxins, and other endotoxins. So it is used for, it is essential for human health and safety. When you bleed the crabs, it is estimated that between 1 to 200,000 crabs die per year. The projected need for LAL is year-over-year growth is substantial. And scientists have also recently discovered that the females that don't die are likely not to lay eggs that year. So you have this double whammy effect. And the adults don't reach sexual maturity until 7 to 12 years of age. So this is a very long-lived species. Think of things like sea turtles. In fact, these horseshoe crabs may live well longer than red knots. So when you remove the females from the population, females are what matters, you have catalytic effect on the crash. Now, the great news is there's a pioneering researcher in Singapore in the 1990s that identified and isolated a compound from horseshoe crab blood and produced a synthetic called recombinant factor C. Now, they had a patent on that product, so you can imagine if you're a J&J, a Merck, an Eli Lilly, or Pfizer, sure, and there's only one source in the world, you can't be hostage to that single source. Now, recombinant factor C has just come off patent, and Jay Bolden and Eli Lilly is leading the way, switching Eli Lilly from limulus amoebocyte lysate, which is the blue gold, the horseshoe crab blood, to this recombinant factor C.
You must be thrilled.
Oh, when I look, I am extremely optimistic. When you look at the projected extinction rates ahead of us, I just came from a conference in St. Louis, and the solution is from people claiming their heritage back, is by refusing to let go of the things that we hold so dear to us. I grew up, and I remember in the 1980s going to the Delaware Bay for the first time. And when the shorebirds took off, it looked like the entire beach was taking flight. The beaches were literally green. So now we look at this opportunity. New Jersey, through an intensive multi-partner effort, enacted a moratorium, the first of its kind in the country in 2008, a permanent moratorium that shuts down the harvest until such time as red knots have recovered, that target population over 100,000. And then the harvest can only resume if it can demonstrate it won't result in a harm to the shorebirds.
So, Eric, so that's New Jersey. What has been the reaction of other Bay states, Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, as far as a possible moratorium is concerned? Because it looks like we're making some ground as far as not using horseshoe crab blood. There's an exciting trend there. But how about harvesting them for bait?
What I'd say with the horseshoe crab blood is we have an exciting spark. We have to move, and it will take a lot of effort in the next 5 years or so to shift the industry. Now, New Jersey has led this way, as well as Delaware. They had a moratorium that was overturned in court in the 2000s. Through our multi-state effort, all the way down to Virginia, we reduced the horseshoe crab quotas in those states. But the first thing to do when you're in a hole is stop digging. Now, there's a really good paper published in 2018 that showed if we had a 10-year moratorium on the harvest of Delaware Bay horseshoe crabs, we would see the horseshoe crab population recover to 80% of its carrying capacity. And you'd have a more than doubling of the red knot in two decades, with a full recovery within 40 years. So according to this modeling, the essential element is a moratorium lasting, according to their projections, 10.8 years. You know, we'll round up in regulatory time to think of 11 years. You can verify that along the way to model, to see if the model is meeting your population estimates. So we have engaged, as a broad community, are working with Eli Lilly and Pfizer, BIO, which is one of the largest trade associations for pharmaceuticals in the United States, to change the regulatory framework for the pharmacy industry in the United States, Japan, and Europe to allow for recombinant factor C. At the same time, we are renewing our efforts with state-based organizations calling on the states of Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, and even New York to enact a moratorium on the harvest of Delaware Bay horseshoe crabs.
So what are the odds you're going to get what you want, what you would like to see?
I always say that good conservation, you measure your success in terms of decades. So New Jersey Audubon, partners like American Littoral Society, National Audubon, American Bird Conservancy, Delaware Nature Society, Maryland Audubon, we've been working on this issue for over 20 years. We've seen incremental gains, but the time to act is now. The science is clear and compelling. The 2018 publication, with the new news of Eli Lilly moving to RFC, shows a clear path to success.
Eric Stiles, you are out there on the beach with these animals. Let's talk about what you saw this year and what the process of checking up on migratory shorebirds looks like. So what did you see when you were out there this year?
What I saw is what I loved. What I saw was a remnant of what I enjoyed as a child. What I saw was the inspiration to ensure that my children and grandchildren will be able to see what I saw as a child. This huge diversity of shorebirds. Now, it's not at the numbers it once was. I was there on the full moon and saw the horseshoe crab spawning, where you saw these ancient creatures clamber out of the Delaware Bay, bumping into one another, digging holes, laying their eggs. What I saw was magic.
So What is the process of actually checking the birds up close look like? You use nets. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's two teams, and they are truly from four continents, international shorebird experts. One uses a cannon net, so they stage the nets in advance when the birds are coming up with a rising tide and they're in a safe position. The cannon nets would go off, and then you have a team of 15 or 20 that rush to the nets and gently get the birds, put them in a holding cage. There are international researchers that measure them, that weigh them, that tag them, and release them.
Do you participate in any of that? Do you hold the bird yourself?
Yeah.
And what does it tell us about that experience?
Oh, boy. How do you put magic in a bottle? So when you hold these birds in your hand, first of all, you realize how light they are. Again, birds have hollow bones. There's a lot of feathers there, so it's surprising how small they are. And it's amazing to think of this small species moving almost from pole to pole. It's also heartwarming that global experts and volunteers have come together to save this species, to study them, to research them, and ultimately to make sure that we can return them to the abundance that the Delaware Bay, the residents of the Mid-Atlantic and the world deserve.
What, does climate change play a significant role in the fate of these populations?
Ultimately, yes.
How so?
So when you look at sea level rise, it will be affecting, and you look at the inward migration of our beaches, if you look at the conditions in the Arctic breeding grounds and on their wintering grounds, climate change will be bringing significant disruption to those systems, which makes the Delaware Bay even that more important. So when you look at the things that we can do, and New Jersey Audubon is calling for a national energy policy and state energy policies that quickly reduce our carbon emissions, as well as moving forward with adaptation, something as simple as a moratorium on the harvest of crabs can increase the resiliency, can reduce the risks. And it's really our global obligation.
So there's the moratorium on crab harvesting. Just for a moment, if you would, talk about habitat loss. Does that need to be addressed along the Delaware Bay to preserve the horseshoe crab population?
So good question. So there is and have been successful efforts recently in New Jersey to engage in post-Hurricane Sandy beach restoration to improve the habitat for spawning conditions and foraging conditions. We've created better roost sites for them. So that has to be part of what we do moving forward. In New Jersey, the other issue had been disturbance. So a lot of people like to walk on the beach, like to walk their dogs on the beach. These shorebirds need to just eat nonstop. And one of the unintended consequences of people walking on the beach was it interferes with the bird's ability to gain weight. So New Jersey has taken these areas and made them off limits during migration. It then opens it up again to the public. The state of Delaware has not done that, so that's an essential component as well.
So I have to stop you there because the music tells us we're just about out of time. But in about 5 seconds, I'm sensing optimism for the future of these migratory birds and the horseshoe crab. Am I getting that right, Eric?
There is optimism if we all come together as a community and reclaim our heritage. And I'm optimistic of the residents in the Delaware Valley.
Eric Stiles, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for the update.
Thank you so much.
Eric Stiles is president and CEO of the New Jersey Audubon Society. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for the Radio Times Regional Roundup.